You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
We're pleased to welcome today Dr. Brandi Daniels, an assistant professor of theology and women's and gender studies at the University of Portland. Her research and teaching explore intersections between constructive and political theologies, social ethics, and feminist and queer theories, particularly around questions of identity, community, and difference. Dr. Daniels has published on such topics as racial identity, post-structuralism, and liberation theory. Her current book project, How? To Be Christian, Identity, Formation, and Difference, engages these themes with particular reference to contemporary feminist theologies. She also is an ordained minister with the Disciples of Christ Church. Dr. Daniels holds a doctorate in religion with an emphasis on theological studies and a certificate in women's and gender studies from Vanderbilt University, a master's degree in humanities, a master of divinity degree, and a certificate in African and African American studies from Duke University, and a bachelor's degree from Azusa Pacific University in Azusa, California. You can find links to Dr. Daniels' University of Portland and LinkedIn pages in the show notes. Dr. Daniels, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome, welcome. I'm going to try really hard not to geek out. I love your work. And I've told Deborah, I've given Deborah permission to keep me in line if it starts to get too in the weeds on like the theory stuff, because I love who you use. So I just want to tell our listeners how I first came to know about your work, Dr. Daniels. I became aware of your article that's titled Abolition Theology or The Abolition of Theology Towards a Negative Theology of Practice. And I was like, what in the heck is negative theology? So that was like, And then why is it in an issue of carceral intersections? So those two things piqued my interest right away. I had to know more. But then I was reading the summary and I was completely hooked. One, because it's so relevant to our podcast and our work, The Incarcerated Christian. And two, you cited Foucault, who I flip and love, and I'm not going to go too deeply into Foucault, I know, for Deborah, but the summary is talking about Foucault announcing the formation of a group of people in France and their activists working to amplify the voices of incarcerated people. And their motto was speech to the detainees, which I love because essentially that's what we do with our work, is try to give a voice to people who are raised in what I call carceral Christianity, what we call the incarcerated Christian. So I just flipping loved it. And then I loved every word of it. One of the things that you emphasize is that we must attend closely, critically, and continually the ways that Christian practices and accounts of them perpetuate and produce harm. And that's what we try to do. It's like, yes, if we have religious assets, let's pass those on. But if there are religious liabilities and they're harming people, let's disrupt that stuff. So that's how I became aware of your work. And that just sent me down a rabbit hole into lots of things, Dr. Brandi Daniels. So I'm very excited to kind of just dig in a little bit to that article, but also want to talk about your greater body of work. But before we do any of that, would you please kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and why you became interested in the things that you study?
Yeah. So as you so kindly read in terms of my bio, I study kind of the intersections of Christian theology in its constructive and political sub-disciplines, ethics and feminist and queer theories. Broadly speaking, my interest in those topics, and particularly in Foucault and the kind of post-structuralist, and I won't go into the theory, don't worry.
you can for me, but we might lose some people.
I grew up evangelical and started down the slippery slope of my own kind of religious trajectory, the happily slippery slope, in undergrad, based on some kind of excellent professors who, a class in particular, History of Biblical Interpretation, who kind of helped me see that, slowly and painfully helped me see that, oh, if I want to take the Bible seriously, I maybe can't take it literally, as I was growing up to think and, you know, slow descent from there. But in divinity school in particular, and I was interested in, my tradition growing up was actually one of the evangelical traditions that's okay with women in ministry. But there's still a very particular version of what that looked like and what womanhood, quote unquote, whatever the heck that means, should look like. But was interested in kind of the ways in divinity school, I didn't quite fit within those typical models. And again, with the destabilizing of my own kind of religious tradition or what it had taught me. And in divinity school, I took a class in feminist theory. And that was the class kind of there that changed my life, and particularly reading Foucault and Judith Butler and being drawn to the kind of, again, post-structural theory, in that recognizing the complex, the ways, and in particular, eventually, queer theory, the ways that norms create ideals and create, that they're not normal, right? Norms don't actually describe the realities of our world, and the way in which they reinscribe certain visions of the world that maybe as the world should be or could be, or the possibilities therein. A quote that particularly stood out to me, it's my one of my favorites. My students have to hear it all the time. But Foucault says at the beginning of Archaeology of Knowledge, he says, "Don't tell me who I am and don't ask me not to change. Leave that to the bureaucrats and the moneymakers. Just spare me their morality when I write," right? So again, like basically is a really fancy, poetic, beautiful way of saying, don't put me in a box, right? What are the ways in which those boxes constrain us? And so I became interested in how that works within the Christian tradition and what resources, what boxes have been created and constructed and reified, stabilized and kind of sedimented. And also what resources there are within the Christian tradition to kind of disrupt or disable and undo those boxes.
Yeah. Okay. You've said so much. I don't even know where to start. There's so many things that I want to just dive right into. One is when you're talking about those boxes, your box would be what our religious cage looks like, religious prison. And you're looking at that not only through racialized identities, gendered identities, sexualized identities, and just identity. You kind of center identities, which I do too. Dr. Daniels, one of the things that I like to say is research as me search. My own research is born out of my history. So I'm very sort of gratified to know that yours is as well. Although I'm glad, also really happy to know that you had a sort of a positive push in toward your deconstruction. And your deconstruction looks at dismantling those kinds of dismantling work. You want to dismantle the boxes to allow people to be freer within them. And you're doing that through the lens of Christianity. And I assume you do that on the academic side, but also on your, are you I know you're an ordained minister. Do you have a church, a congregation?
I do not have a congregation. My tradition, Disciples of Christ Christian Church, Christian Church Disciples of Christ. I always get the order. Yeah. Ordains to things beyond parish work. So I'm actually ordained to teach. I'm also ordained to kind of activist work, and I serve, I'm part of a group called Portland Interfaith Clergy Resistance, a group of interfaith clergy that serve as, in effect, street chaplains at protests and social justice movement work. So standing with, alongside protesters and as part of protests, but serving as kind of spiritual support, the religious version of like the ACLU's like legal observers.
Yeah, I like it. No, that's perfect. And activism, I mean, that is definitely theological work. Oh, gosh. See, here's where I get so excited when we talk to some people. Like, I have so many thoughts flashing around in my head right now. I'm like, which one do I want to go for first? Which one do I want to go for first? Can we go back to your article first and then kind of use that to sort of jump off? So in your article, and I promise I'm not going to quote from this, but I definitely want to talk about it because so your article talks about moving toward a negative theology of practice. And you're one of the things that you do, and I think this is part of your kind of public theologian work, maybe you can tell me if that's wrong. And one of the things that I love your work is you are, as an ordained minister, you have a whole other level of authority to sort of poke at these problems from the inside. I was telling Deborah before we got on the call today that I gave up trying to do that because I was not in a position of authority. I was raised Southern Baptist, so women don't preach from the, you know, we don't preach and we don't have those kinds of, we don't have that kind of authority. So I moved outside of it. One of the things that I absolutely loved about this particular article is that you are challenging other theologians to take a hard look at the practices within the church that are harmful to people. And do you call that, is that the abolitionist imagination?
I think so. Yeah. And okay. I'm of course stealing, you know, from abolitionist work in general and then stealing from, riffing off of rather, one might say.
Yeah. I like the riff.
With citational practice, Lindell McGorder's work on the abolition of philosophy. So largely shaped by her kind of imagination there in terms of how we think about academic reflection via Foucault in relation to people's lives and what that means for theology and in theology, which is deeply oriented to, at least theoretically speaking, people's lives.
Yes. And importantly, and this is another reason I got all excited, because you put such a primacy on centering the voices of people, the marginalized people, or, you know, just being in a marginalized position. So Deborah and I were talking that part of the way that I talk about my own experience as an incarcerated Christian is through my, it's gendered identity. That's what I have. And I was telling, we were talking about how, you know, that's all it was. It wasn't race plus gender or some other combination. And I'm saying all it was, not in a qualitative way, because that was enough, right? That was enough. But I so appreciate that you put such an emphasis on talking to people who are impacted, because I feel like one of the three reactions that I get a lot when I talk about my own research is one of the biggest ones is, oh, well, those people are just the exception, as if I don't think it's an exception, but as if being an exception is okay because people want to protect the structure of that particular religious tradition. So you're trying to strike at that particular religious tradition to say, no, no. And you're doing that through the voices of people.
Yeah. And I get that. I mean, from a lot of different sources, right? Foucault being one of them and his own work, particularly with the Prison Information Group, the GIP. I don't speak French, but you know, that's why the order is different there. I can read it, but not speak it. But again, the speech to the detainees, right? So there's—
Yes, I love that.
But also from liberation theology, right? Gustavo Gutierrez and James Cone about, you know, who God's preferential option for the poor and the oppressed and the ways that that's gotten taken up in different kind of liberation theologies of race, class, gender, sexuality, and so on. And then finally, not finally in terms of exhaustively, but in terms of what I'll mention, in queer theory, I think there's, again, because of its emphasis on moving beyond inclusion and seeing the limits and the problems with the logic of inclusion to one of an identity-based logic to one about critically analyzing, challenging, and dismantling norms.
Yes.
Being particularly geared towards a kind of an undoing, a project of undoing, right? On behalf of people's freedom and liberation.
Well, and that's one of the things you talked about in your article. Oh, I see you, Deborah. Is that so importantly, you said the dismantling may be the end of the structure, but it's important work that we have to do. Deborah, was that what you were going to ask?
Well, it's related to what I was going to ask. I was going to ask, and I will do it now. Can you give us some examples of dismantling the structure?
Oh boy, that's a great
question. Examples of things that need to be dismantled.
Prisons, incarceral systems, the prison industrial complex, thinking about how we conceive of punishment and rehabilitation. I emphasize punishment because I think our current carceral system is far, far more about punishment and profit than about rehabilitation and justice. And even the logic of rehabilitation, right? Of who's being rehabilitated. Is this an individual concern, right? So, or is this something societal that we have to rethink about, that the individual is a part of, but also, you know, there's a reason that prison architects look at data from elementary schools, right, when they're building their prisons, right? What's going on there, right? And so a lot of the dismantling question is a hard one for me, not in terms of what needs to be dismantled, but in terms of what comes next, in part because that's about imagination. But I think part of at the heart of the dismantling work for me is epistemological. It's about how we think, right? What possibilities we see there, right? I teach a course in queer theology, and my students sign up for the course thinking it's a course about theology for LGBTQ people and about LGBTQ people. Sure, yes, but also no, right? It's not about including LGBTQ people in the current order of things, right? That's not at the heart of queer theory, right? That's LGBTQ theology, but not so much queer theology, right? But it's about raising questions about how do we, you know, do we want to add more people to a table that's fundamentally broken, or do we want to rebuild the table, right? How do we think about marriage, right? Why, oh, cool, LGBTQ people, or gay and lesbian couples can get married. Why do you need to get married for healthcare, right? What's going on there, right? Like, how do we rethink how we imagine society, right? Rather than just who gets in, right?
Mm-hmm. And who decides? Who gets in? Who decides? That who decides part is, of course, Harry, I'm going to geek out again on Foucault because he, a huge piece of what he looks at are the power dynamics. And I was talking with Deborah earlier about his nook and cranny power. Like, I tend to pick apart like little things, but the little things are really important because some one little thing could hold a lot of power. And, you know, one of my favorite examples inside a church is I was attending a relative's funeral, and they always do a dinner for people. And so I was in the kitchen, and there was a sign above the kitchen sink that said, you know, if Jesus were standing here, would you leave the dishes in the sink? You know, that's like nook and cranny power. Oh my goodness, I better do these dishes to be a good Christian. But also it's a gendered message because it's women in the kitchen. It's not the men doing the dishes in the kitchen. So anyway, but you can't look at dismantling work without looking at the power dynamics.
Yeah. And the power dynamics on such a kind of diffuse level, right? Of not only who holds power or where is power wielded, but how does power itself, how is, you know, again, Foucault's kind of one of his central points in History of Sexuality, Volume 1. When I teach Foucault, I always kind of almost immediately turn students to HS1, History of Sexuality, Volume 1, pages 94 to 98 in the Rutledge edition, where he kind of gives his outlines about what power is and isn't, and power as being productive and diffuse and multidirectional, and not only is that enforcing a logic of power, right, but it's getting people to enforce that power themselves, right? His notion of like disciplinary power, right? And my students have such a hard time sometimes. They eventually get it, like, whoa. Mm-hmm. Grasping that, like, no, it's not just that's power wielded over subjects. It's that power creates the idea of subjects.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And you know, we talk about disciplinary power even in my intro classes of like, you know, we're a student where Foucault says, you know, the prison is the prison, and the production of docile bodies, you don't even need the prisoner. You don't even need the prison guard in the Panopticon Center, right? The people will eventually police themselves and police each other. Foucault says, you know, the factory is the prison. The school is the prison. And I do like little exercises to show students, and even like first year students, the first couple weeks of class, they'll raise their hand and be like, can I go to the bathroom? And I'm like, of course you can go to the bathroom. Like, you are an adult. Like, you do you. Why yeah. are you needing to ask that? What's going on there?
Yeah.
So the ways in which kind of power gets internalized, and we police ourselves, we have these kind of identities that we name for ourselves that offer opportunity, but also kind of foreclose possibility.
So you gave a couple of examples there. How would you relate that to the church structure?
Oh, yes.
How many hours do we have? No.
No, and I think it depends, right? It depends on what church. And I think one of Foucault's and others, Foucauldians and queer theorists point of like kind of the insistence on a kind of local of it, you know, which church, what tactics get utilized, how is power operating in that particular situation, kind of the importance of particularity. So with particularity in mind, I mean, I loved, Robin, your example, right, of, again, the like little note on the counter, right, or just what are expectations. So the church I grew up in.
What church did you grow up in?
I grew up Assemblies of God.
Assemblies of God, okay, yep.
So Pentecostal, evangelical. You know, I was part of Missionettes and, you know, let's compare what the Missionettes did, the Christian Girl Scouts, right? Our Christian Girl Scouts, not like, you know, versus what the Royal Rangers did. Oh, what's going on there, right? What are the norms for what badges women get versus what men get? And then also, right, like when you reach the like highest level, when you go through all the whole process, you become an honor star. It's basically, in effect, the ceremony is like a mini wedding ceremony where you're like, dad walks you down the aisle of like, oh, what's going on there, right? Like what, you know, the telos is marriage in a weird, like, but also not, right? So, oh, what, and that's a compelling telos for lots of people for lots of different reasons, right? And those reasons aren't bad or good necessarily, but like trying to understand what kind of power is operating there. I ask my students like what they desire, what they want, you know, about this or that. And they'll say this. And I say, well, is that you or is that society? And they're like, totally me. You know, and if they say, oh, it's totally society, I'm like, but it's also you. The ways we internalize different things.
For sure. And different people can internalize differently. I think about, you know, my level of internalization of the teachings and practices, you know, when I was growing up versus even my sister. And she didn't internalize it as deeply as I did. So my deconstruction journey was a lot more intense because I internalized every bit of it. Just thought I was going to go to hell for lots of different reasons. But hey, and I have a funny follow up, or maybe it's not funny, but the badges. One of the first thoughts I had was, you know, we used to get not badges, but something similar. But some of our badges would be in the ways that we were taking care of the boys and men. But of course, the boys and men didn't have badges for how they, you know, taking care of us. So, so that alone sort of shows you where the power is directed.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I saw a tweet yesterday that was about the new Texas law, right? And what does it say that, you know, the punishment for someone who, quote unquote, sorry about the dog there, quote unquote, assists women, like drives a woman to a doctor's appointment at Planned Parenthood, gets a greater fine than someone who raped that woman.
Like, yeah, right.
What's
right,
going on there? What are the ways punishments get doled out, enforced?
That's right. And it's, you know, I was thinking like on the punishment side, it's you do get punishment for not sort of measuring up to like, Christian, right? Being a good Christian. There are punishments for not being a good Christian, but there are lots of rewards for being a good one. And, you know, a lot of times the rewards keep people moving. It's not all negative. It's like there's a lot of positive forces at work too that kind of keep us contained in our little boxes, our little cages. Can you speak a little bit more about, you mentioned liberation theology, and I always think about Martin Luther King Jr. when I think about liberation theology. Is he a good one to include within that realm, or would you describe liberation theology for us?
Yeah. So one can think about the history. Oftentimes liberation theology in particular gets associated with Gustavo Gutierrez and his book, A Theology of Liberation. but in particular, he was shaped deeply. And I'm trying to remember back on my, I don't have my slides in front of me.
It's like memory.
I can talk about queer theory and feminist theology from memory, but liberation theology I'm a little murkier on. So like in terms of details, but a particular conference in Medellin that happened after Vatican II. He was a Catholic theologian and deeply shaped him, Leonardo Boff, both Boffs, the Boff brothers, and a handful of other thinkers who were wanting to think the gospel rethink the gospel beyond the individual, and thinking about and rethink beyond kind of a telos of the spiritual, but saying the gospel is very embodied, very practical, very real. And what is the message of, you know, if we look at the story of the sheep and the goats, or if we look at the Beatitudes, what does it mean to really take those things seriously, right? And we see a clear precedent and consistent vision throughout Christian scriptures and tradition of God's preferential option for the poor. So right around the same time, and what does it look like to enact that and try to bring the kingdom of heaven to earth? Right? What did Jesus do? Where did what might it mean to try to embody that vision? In one of the things, so at the same, around the same time that that's happening in Latin America, James Cone is raising questions here in the U.S. on Black theology and Black power and a Black theology of liberation. That was a later book. But James Cone's first book actually came out before Gutierrez's first book, right? And saying, oh, what is the gospel message for Black people in the U.S., right? And not only what is the gospel message for, what is the call for, but how do we even understand the gospels, right? And to understand that, you know, if the gospels are for and about the oppressed, and we see that in the conditions of Jesus himself, how does that not only change what we do with the gospel message, but how we understand it, right? And Cone has some very excellent stuff of like, Jesus was Black, y'all. How do we understand Jesus's identity? It's not only a message of charity, it's a message of transformation, right? Like, again, it's epistemological, that has ethical implications, but it's not about what we do with it, right? It's not about, so we should care for, you know, it's about how's the system set up. And right around the same time too, Mary Daly wrote The Church and the Second Sex. And again, speaking from a Catholic church context, but in the U.S., right, of saying, or was it The Church and Second Sex was first, and then later Beyond God the Father, right? How is our imagery for God shaped by certain power structures and ways of being in the world, and what might it mean to think that differently, given this message of liberation?
Well, one quick comment, and then I have a follow-up question, but I was also sharing with Deborah today. I feel like I've been talking to you a lot today, Deborah. I got all excited for this interview, though, and I was just thinking about all these things. I saw a funny TikTok video last night. And it's a video where, you know how there's a person that goes, you know, that asks a question and then somebody else will jump in. Well, somebody asked the question, tell me something about the Bible that I don't know. And then cut to the person responding. And the person said, there aren't any white people in it. And then they were like, bet you weren't ready for that one, were you? Right. It's so mind blowing, though, because, you know, being raised, a lot of us are raised that, you know, Jesus is white and, you know, everybody in the Bible is white. So to have that challenged is like that. Well, yeah, he wouldn't have been white. Right. I mean, and so anyway, oh, shoot. Now I forgot my question because I got all down the road with a TikTok video. So you're a feminist theologian and a public theologian. I'm curious if you would identify as other kinds of theologians. Is the public theologian piece of it, is that the work you were describing, you know, out and about amongst the protests and all of that? Is that part of being a public theologian?
Yeah. So I did a postdoc right before I started at the University of Portland at the University of Virginia on religion and its publics, right? So how religion engages the public sphere. So oftentimes I think we think of a public theologian as someone who like does their theology for the public. I'm not that I want my theology to be relevant, but I also have questions of like, who's the public, right? Who's the state? Is the academy is the public too, right?
Ah, who's
not,
the public?
It's not, but also I'm particularly interested again in the kind of how we know questions. So how theology can learn from the public, right? Of who are the sources of our theology? Oftentimes, and this was one of the things I'm trying to get at a teeny bit in the abolition theology piece, right? Of we think about, oh, what can theology tell us about what to do with practices? But I'm also curious about what practices that happen in the real world can tell us about how to do theology. Another quote I particularly love, I don't love the source, but you know, that's complicated. Carl Schmitt. Yeah, not great. But in he's writing a letter, he's writing back and forth to Jacob Taubes, right? A Jewish theologian. So yeah, that adds a level of like confusion. But he says at one point in a letter to Taubes, he says, all things are theology except what the theologians are talking about.
Ah,
that quote, right?
Wow, that is very cool.
Where are the sources of reflection on and talk about the divine, right? Where do we see that happening? Is that just happening by theologians or is that happening in the world? And what can those of us who are tasked with this work of doing academic theology learn from different sources? How can we expand our own canons, right? So I'm more interested in what public scholarship than public theology, if that makes sense.
And yeah, that does.
But I want it to be more circular and multidirectional. Then like, here's what I, as a knower of books and knowledge, can teach the world. I'm more of like, oh, what am I missing? What am I not reading? What am I not seeing? Not reading both in terms of what text am I overlooking, but also like, what things in the world am I not looking at correctly or enough?
Well, what are you learning from that experience?
That's a great question. So many things. I think I'm learning about imagination and different possibilities, right? Of what possibilities open up if we expand our canons, right? And we expand our visions. You know, oftentimes, for instance, when people want to like re-envision church, they'll do different music or they'll meet a different time of day, right? Or they'll go back to smells and bells in a certain kind of way. But the structure's still the same, right? Oh, what might it mean to like learn from people who are gathering as community in different contexts? What might it mean to say, my work at protest is me going to church in some sense, right? Fellowship with other believers, seeking to enact and speak to the message of the gospel. What do I think of preaching? Where is preaching? Where do I find preaching? Yeah, God only knows, right? And it's preaching. You know, what is prayer, right? How can I learn differently about prayer from Buddhist meditation or from reading poetry, right? So I think the answers to that question are multiple. It depends on the context. What can I learn from my students? What can I learn, insert XYZ here, right? But kind of different, we don't, you know, the whole thing of like, we don't know what we don't know. So I learn different things I don't know.
Yeah. And that feeds you. That's part of your spiritual practice is learning things you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, can I ask you, since you mentioned your students, do you, I know when I've lectured or guest lectured in a class on our campus, that anytime I talk about my research, invariably I get students who come up to me after class and want to pray with me and tell me it's okay and want to save me. And I'm like, you don't really have to do any of that. I mean, it's like the assumptions that they make because I ask the questions or point out the harms. I sometimes wonder, is it just because of where I am, you know, the kind of the buckle of the Bible Belt kind of area? How do your students receive? I know it might be different depending upon the class, because some of them, I imagine that some of your classes are real refuge.
Yeah, I think so. Again, before University of Portland, I was at University of Virginia, right, which is a public state school. And then I came to University of Portland, which is a private Catholic school, Roman Catholic school, Holy Cross. And I taught the same, I taught Christianity, gender, and sexuality at both, or I guess my class was a little bit different at UVA, but basically the same gist. And I have students do an initial, like in the first day of class, we did like an initial kind of brainstorm together of like word cloud free association thing, right? Like, what do you think of when you think of Christianity, gender, and sexuality? And I was pretty thrown when at UP, students were like, Christianity's homophobic.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Yeah.
And I think that, and that's one example of many. Yeah. Right? It's just the first, it was one that kind of threw me. Whereas at UV, and obviously there's variations and differences, but it was just a kind of ethos or a trend that I noticed. Whereas at UVA, I had more of, well, you know, Christianity tries hard, but you know, it wants to not condemn, it loves the people, but wants to be clear about certain behaviors. And I was like, oh, you know, right. So it operated the opposite of how I expected it to in terms of but I think location, class issues, race and gender, right? All of those kind of things came into play. And I think Portland is a very particular, and traditions, the way the Catholic tradition engages with the world is a little bit different than the way UVA had a large evangelical student body. There's very few evangelicals at UP. And so different kind of ways of approaching the question. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here, you know, there's a good segment of LGBTQ students at UP, and they tended to sign up for my classes.
Yeah.
So again, it was more of like more skepticism, a healthy skepticism and complex kind of grappling with histories of Christianity while trying to understand their faith in relation to that, rather than a skepticism of kind of gender and sexual diversity and difference.
I want to hop back for just one second back to some of the ways and means that you were describing, like the poetry and all of those different things. What are your favorite, your personally favorite go-to means for kind of spiritual, look at that, sweetie, for listeners, we're looking at one of her two adorable dogs. Dr. Daniels, yeah, what are your favorite means of just spiritual nourishment, you personally?
So nourishment.
What fills you? Feeds your spirit.
Reading.
That's one of mine. Yeah.
Knowledge that's kind of my go-to of, you know, there's a reason I went into theology, right? It was a habit that was ingrained in me pretty early on. Yeah. Reading and what that reading is will change by season and season and mood and vision and different forms of community. And part of the reason I honed in on the nourishment and I would say social justice movement work, things like protests, I think those challenge me more than I don't want to make a like binary between nourishing and like challenging, but I think the growth goes beyond like nourishment in different activist contexts. There is a nourishment there. It's just, you know, it's like eating the vegetables you don't like that are really good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say activism makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but kind of orientations towards difference and in the pursuit of justice. I was in a delightful conversation the other day with someone who is part of Rose City Antifa, the first kind of named Antifa group in the U.S., Germany and Italy, post-Second World War, right? And Antifa has like a lot of connotations now, but you know, I'm of course anti-fascist, like 110%, right? But one of the strategies of anti-fascist organizing is a kind of level of anonymity. And I was talking to this person and it was really interesting because they were talking about I had questions about like what that meant for them and what that looks like in terms of things like community. And they then turned it into something around like discipleship and a spiritual practice of avoiding making it about them.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of the tendencies, the risks of especially because anti-fascism is kind of either seen as totally scorned or sexy. Right. And depending on which cultural space you're in, the wanting to kind of get under the limelight. Right. And like, no, like I'm anonymous. Like some people in this person's life don't even know what they do and that they're part of this organization. Right. Because they're like, that makes it about me. And this work isn't about me, about commitment to social justice and liberation and against like fascist oppression. So, you know, different ways of difference there that show up in different forms of protest work. Right. How to navigate. Right. So things like that surprise me, that are both nourishing and challenging.
Yeah, that's great. What about running? I think you mentioned, running too for you?
Running too for me. Definitely. Yeah. That's a getting out of my head kind of one, right? I'm a academic, right? It's always in my head, but always where I can kind of zone out. Running is one of those.
What about learning from your students? Would you consider that a form of spiritual nourishment?
Oh, totally.
Or personal nourishment?
Oh, totally. Yeah. In so many ways, right? Both personally, academically, different experiences they've had, different demonstrations of courage or boldness or truth or pursuing of liberation or resilience. And then academically, things I learn about like ways of looking, ways of seeing, different insights that they offer. Pedagogically, how to be a better teacher.
Yeah. Does that inform your research and your other work outside the classroom?
Definitely.
How so?
For instance, a project I started working on this summer, I need to finish the first book, but a project I started working on this summer is a second project on intersections of activism and faith and theology. And it was shaped by something in the classroom and particularly interest among some of my students about like what this looks like on the ground. I've never done ethnographic research before. I had no idea what I was doing, but I applied for a grant to do a project of ethnographic research and hired two students to help me do it. And so like literally shaping the direction of my research. And then, you know, the questions they bring to the table when we meet and the interviews they do with different community members that we're doing this research on, right? Like, they ask different questions. Well, the questions we ask are all said the same because of IRB, but like they approach those questions differently. They get different answers back, right? So that's the most concrete example of how they've shaped my, yeah.
We cannot get to the end of this interview without asking you about your book. I can't even believe that I haven't asked about this yet. It's your current book project is titled so far, How Not. Oh, well, you did mention that in the intro. Would you talk to us about your book?
Yeah, it's hard to talk about because I'm in the thick of it, but at the heart of what I'm asking questions about is how to think formation, right? This question of how do we become who we are and how are we formed in certain ways, right? Or what are we formed to? Things like catechesis. And particularly within Christian contexts, right? What does formation look like? What is you know, cruciformity, or what does discipleship look like? And we tend to have particular visions and particular practices about what we think that is, right? So how do we think formation together with intersectionality, with difference, and with intersecting differences of how do we tell people, how do we train people in religious communities to be formed in their faith in a way that also values and embraces difference? Oftentimes, I think formation and intersectionality are seen as kind of two different things, and I'm curious about where they cross or how they could cross more. And particularly, it's a drawing off of my dissertation and looking at how in feminist theology, particularly about feminist theologies in the last 10, 20 years, have kind of taken up gender theory and said, oh, yes, like, look, we read Judith Butler. We think gender is fluid. And then they say, well, buy in towards God. And I want to say, okay, cool. I want to know more about what that means. And I still, you know, despite having studied this for a while, I'm still not quite sure what that means. But I'm also the question I want to ask back, or that I do ask back, or plan to ask back, is sure. But also, how is our experience of God, our relationship with God, our religion, our understanding of ourselves as Christians, for those who, again, I'm speaking within a Christian theological context, also shaped by and towards our gender?
Exactly.
Why is that unidirectional in a certain sort of sense, right? Like how can methodologically and ethically our religious identity itself be fluid
yes.
by other identities in our lives and experiences in our lives?
I love this. I cannot wait for this book to come out. Just put me on the pre-order list right now. I definitely want to read this. One of the things that you said reminded me of, we had a guest on the show named Carrie Doering, and one of her books was so, do you know Carrie?
I know of Carrie. We have mutual friends.
Okay. Well, she, her dissertation, which I think then got printed as a book or put in a book form.
Yeah, whatever. I think she's a Vanderbilt grad.
I think that's right. But she was talking about the reason that it resonated so much with me is she was talking in this book about how your concept of God is informed by your experiences. And if your experiences are formed within the context of, you know, sexual abuse or other kinds of abuse, then your concept of God is going to, you know, it'll be like a cold, judgmental, harsh. It's not the warm, fuzzy God. And that was mind-blowing to me back in the day when I read it. I just was like, okay, this is why I've never connected with God. I just always had such a kind of like, God doesn't like girls, you know, like, you know. So I can't wait to see. I mean, to me, that just relates to what you're talking about, how our experience of God is shaped by gender or shaped by sexuality or shaped by our race or shaped by our identity.
And one of the things I'm interested in relation to that and building on kind of what you all talked with Carrie about, right? For that short synopsis of that, right? And it is, how can we even learn from difference there? Not that like, okay, so, oh, maybe God is a terrible judging person because those were certain people's experience of God. But like, what do we miss about God when we only look at a certain normative experience?
Yes, exactly. Like,
what can we learn from that? Is the vision this, I have problems with even the notion of like health or wholeness of, are any of us whole this side of the eschaton, right? And how are even our ideals of what wholeness is limited by our own experiences, right? So
yes,
being different, painful, and certainly not normative experiences teach us about the divine, ourselves, one another. Again, not being like, maybe God is this, right? Like in a negative way, but what can we learn there?
Right. And there certainly are. And Deborah and I talk about this a lot because, you know, those experiences, if you transform them, become gifts. They don't stay, you know, like my concept of God, whatever that is very different from my concept of God when I was growing up. And that is a gift. So, yeah. Oh, Dr. Daniels, it's been so lovely talking with you.
Thank you.
Just so lovely talking with you. Deborah, do you have other questions?
I don't. And it's a good thing because it would take us into way over where we need to be time-wise.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? When your book comes out, we'd love to have you back and just walk us through the book because I know that I'll have a whole series of questions that come out of that. And it was lovely to see your little doggies.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Sorry for the occasional barks there.
No, they are wonderful.
I'm proud of them.
We don't mind at all.
No. But thank you. Thank you for the time. We just so appreciate it and just can't wait to see where you go next. And you've given me a little bit more to think about in terms of activism as church. Rallies this church, like protests. That's so good. That's so good to think about.
And again, listeners, we'll have links in the show notes to Dr. Daniels, University of Portland faculty, and LinkedIn pages. Is there anything else that you would like us to link in the show notes?
Yeah. Is there another way that people can get a hold of you if they want to?
I mean, you can find me from
your faculty page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only thing at UpTalk is like groups that I'm connected with, right? Like Portland Interfaith Clergy Resistance. But I can, you know, all that stuff's on my own stuff anyways, right?
Again,
how are ways people can get plugged in and support different communities that are doing the work.
Perfect. Thank you so much. It was such a delight having you today.
That's wonderful. Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.